afternoon. If you're a regular member here, you know that we've been going through the book of 1 Corinthians the past few months, and we're going to continue that study tonight, looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 8. I'll tell you, when I got out of 1 Corinthians 7, I thought, well, I can take a little breather now. This is going to get easier, and it doesn't get any easier, really. What I learned in preparing for this lesson is I thought I had an understanding of this, and I don't. Or I do now more than I did when I started the study, hopefully. But this section of 1 Corinthians is challenging, and it does take some comparing to some other places to have a proper understanding. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul teaches us how to keep from causing others to stumble by limiting the use of our freedoms and rights. And I think many of us have an understanding that that is required of us as Christians. And Paul talks about that in the next three chapters, in chapters 8, 9, and 10. Probably all of our lives we've been told how dangerous tripping is. One of the things, if you go to a theme park, they have people there stationed to tell you to watch your step. And at different places, if you're getting on a bus, people are telling you to watch your step. Your parents probably tell you, don't trip your brothers and sisters. In fact, in many sports, it's something that is illegal in many sports. While you can tackle somebody, you can't trip them, right? So that's the case in many different areas of our life. That tripping is dangerous. It's against the rules, and it's also the case in the church. Not that I'm going to be waiting at the door to trip you, but what we understand here is that what was happening in Corinth is that there would be those that were tripping somebody else, causing somebody to violate their conscience. And there were some specific situations that there were questions about. And I believe that the proper way of understanding chapter 8 is, as we have understood much of 1 Corinthians, is that there were specific problems that Paul was addressing. And people had specific questions to which Paul was replying. And so many of the things that we see quoted here, maybe your translation has some quote marks around different phrases, with the understanding that these were the quotes, these were the common understandings that the Corinthians had, and then Paul replied to those things. And so when we look at the beginning of chapter 8, he turns his focus away from the issues that we were discussing previously, the issues with marriage and divorce and those kind of things that we discussed in chapter 7, and he turns his attention to another subject. He says, now concerning food offered to idols. And so he's turning his attention to this, your translation may say meat offered to idols or meat sacrificed to idols. So it appears that there was some kind of controversy among the Corinthian Christians whether or not it was permissible for them to eat meat from animals that had been used in pagan sacrifices. And based on other things that we see in the New Testament, you might expect Paul to give a simple and straightforward answer, because elsewhere in the New Testament, the answer is pretty cut and dried. If you look back at Acts chapter 15, there's a controversy in Jerusalem regarding circumcision and some other things that the Jewish converts were telling the Gentile converts that they needed to do. And the apostles and the elders of the Jerusalem church got together, and they came out with some instruction to the church there, if you remember that. And in Acts chapter 15, one of the things that was specifically addressed was were told in verse 29 of Acts 15, you are to abstain from food offered to idols. And one of the issues that you see in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 is sometimes people take this section of Scripture and say that, well, food offered to idols doesn't mean anything. But that doesn't square with what was said in Acts. And so you have to be real careful about how you interpret what Paul is saying here, because it can't contradict what God said on another occasion. And in fact, there is another mention of this in the New Testament in the book of Revelation chapter 2. And in the letters to the seven churches, and the churches of Pergamum and Thyatira were corrected for tolerating practices of eating meat offered to idols or sacrificed to idols, as you see in the Revelation chapter 2. So when you look at those two references elsewhere, and they're brief references, but Paul here in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 does not render a simple judgment regarding this question. In fact, he goes into a lot of detail in a long and complex answer, and it covers three chapters. And we're not going to cover all of that tonight, but this answer that he is giving regarding this question covers chapters 8, 9, and 10. And so, this must have been a question that was raised by the Corinthians in their letter to Paul. And let's go ahead and read just the beginning of this. Now, concerning food offered to idols, we know that, quote, all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, but he does not yet know it, he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. And so, there are four different, I'm going to call them movements. For those of you that are musically inclined, you know you shouldn't applaud between each one of these either. But these different movements that Paul is addressing here, the first movement here is in chapter 8, and you can kind of sum this one up as knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. The second movement is in chapter 9, where Paul uses himself as an example of somebody that has some liberty in some areas, but he is going to sacrifice his liberty for the benefit of others. He's going to renounce his own rights. And then in chapter 10, verses 1 through 22, Paul offers a warning against idolatry. In the final part of chapter 10, Paul encourages people to use their freedom for the glory of God. And so these are really the four different areas that you'll see in these three different chapters. So we'll look at each one of those things in some detail in the next couple of weeks as we go through these other two chapters. But for right now, what we see is that Paul is crafting a pretty elaborate argument concerning idol meat. And what that shows us is that this must have been a significant question. I mean, it's not something that means a whole lot to us in our life, although we'll make some applications to it because there certainly are some applications. But this was important to the people in Corinth, and it was important that Paul address that. So, yeah, it may seem obscure from our point of view, but we should look at it seriously. Meat sacrifice to idols was a hot-button issue in Corinth, and it exposed three larger concerns that were enveloped in this. That, Corinth was a city that had a lot of pagan things going on. And so they're in the midst of a lot of things that Paul is needing to address because the church is being pulled by their society. And just much like we are today. In fact, somebody this morning said that I ought to preach a lesson on modest apparel. Why is that? Well, it's something in our society that needs to be addressed because we tend to go after and do what other people in our society do, and we pattern ourselves many times after things that are not godly. And so here, there is this problem of boundaries between the church and pagan culture that doesn't need to be blurred. And there's also some issues that Paul exposes in Corinth, that there are some strained relations between different social classes, that there were problems between the rich and the poor in the church. And there's this relationship between those that think that they have knowledge and love, and some issues with that as well. Those that think they have knowledge are not always filled with the love for one another as they should be. So at the beginning of chapter 8, it seems that Paul is using the same kind of method that he's used before, that he's addressing a quotation from them, something that they think about a particular subject, and then answers those questions. So he reflects those views back on them in verses 1 and verses 4 and verses 8. So if you notice here in verse 1, all of us possess knowledge. And Paul's not saying we all possess knowledge. He's saying you said we all possess knowledge. I'm quoting you. You said we all possess knowledge. And in verse 4, he said, therefore, as to the eating of the food offered to idols, we know that, quote, an idol has no real existence. So he's quoting what they say about that. They're right about that. An idol doesn't have any existence. But they're using, we'll see that they're using that as a justification for certain things. And so the idol has no existence, and there is no God but one. And so those are some foundational things that they believe that they are using as a jumping off point to go into some other areas. And also in verse 8, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat and no better off if we do. So again, that's something that's being, that's an opinion of theirs that is being addressed. So with that said, the overall question that's being asked, are Christians free to eat meat from animals slaughtered in pagan cultic rituals? And Paul's discussion of this suggests that this issue had arisen because some of the Christians may have been attending these feasts held in pagan temples where meat was served to everybody that's present. And so based on what we've seen here, based on his remarks, we can reconstruct the justification that's being used to those that may be involved in these things. How are they going to defend their behavior? Well, they could claim, as enlightened Christians, we all possess knowledge. And we know, based on our knowledge, that there's only one God, and that the pagan idols are nothing. What are they? Well, they're lifeless statues. And they don't have any power to help us. They don't have any power to hurt us. And so, you know, this food also is something that's insignificant. It's spiritually insignificant. So if we understand that the idol is nothing and that the food is insignificant and we have this knowledge ourselves, then we're just free to do what we want to with this. So they understood as Gentiles that they didn't need to seek God's approval through keeping Jewish dietary laws. That's pretty clear. So they also think that they don't need to worry about the source of the meat that they're eating. And Christians who feared defilement from idol meat were weak. And they were superstitious and ignorant. But the ones who had knowledge knew that the idols are nothing and that the meat's fine and we don't need to worry about that. So in the mind of the strong Christians at Corinth, you know, armed with this knowledge that they had, they could go into pagan temples and eat whatever was offered there without any kind of guilt or without any hesitation. In fact, it seemed that this may be their way of demonstrating that they did have knowledge, that they were more mature than others, and they recognized that they had freedom to do this. And, you know, some of their more, you know, weak or scrupulous brothers and sisters, you know, they want them to build up the strength of their own consciences by having them participate in the same thing. If they would do that, they would see there's no harm to it. And, you know, their consciences could come up to the level of those who had knowledge. And so that's the idea of what we have here. There's also, you know, reasons to see that there could have been a socioeconomic impact here about the idol food, because the feast that was offered in pagan temples, it was something that was pretty common in the life of the Greeks. And in fact, there was a temple or sanctuary in Corinth that was used for cultic sacrifices and had many dining rooms. And the wealthier Corinthians would have been invited to eat meals in these places as part of their regular social life, to celebrate birthdays and weddings and or healings attributed to a pagan god or what have you. And so the Corinthians who might have been among the wealthier class, this was something that would have been commonplace. And they may have even thought that their attendance was required at these kind of things. And so, you know, to eat sacrificial meat that was offered on these occasions, they might think, well, I'm going to be rude if I don't eat that. You know, I'm going to partake in those things so I'm not offensive to the host. And on the other hand, you know, you had the ones that were more poor, and this meat eating would not have been so commonplace. Meat was expensive, as it is today, Many times it was not part of the ordinary diet of those that were poor and may have only been available at certain public religious festivities where there was a general distribution of the meat. And we'll see more about that in chapter 10. So there could be some that were likely to regard this idol meat as laden with all kinds of religious connotations. And therefore, they wanted to abstain from it. So you've got these two different groups. And so, with all that said, Paul's responding to this type of situation in Corinth. You've got this strong group, the one that's full of knowledge, in Corinth. And so, you know, when you look at it from the surface, and they say, well, we all possess knowledge, and we have this knowledge that the idol really has no existence and there's nothing to the food, you know, that they may have thought, well, that's pretty good argument, and felt kind of puffed up about that. But, you know, Paul doesn't use this opportunity to say, yes, you're all okay. You know, you're absolutely right in what you are saying. He did not take their side, but he challenged their knowledge to consider their actions by some different standards. And so he suggests that knowledge is not really the be-all, end-all. He says this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So if you think that you have this knowledge, how does that affect others? Well, if you think that you're so smart, then that puffs you up, and it doesn't really have the right effect on others. He said that love is something that is stronger. If anyone imagines he knows something, yet he does not know as he ought to know. He does not know yet as he ought to know, but if anyone loves God, he is known by God. And so that's Paul's response, is that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And I want us to be careful in understanding Paul's use of knowledge here, because we have a desire for the truth. And Paul is not saying that truth needs to be thrown out and all we have to do is love one another. That's not what he's saying. He said this knowledge that you think you have about this particular situation may be a little flawed because you're leaving some considerations out, namely how you have an effect on one another. So in contrast to this so-called supremacy of knowledge, Paul insists that they need to involve love in that. In verse 2 and 3, if anyone imagines that he knows something he does not yet know as he ought to know, I would paraphrase that to say, well, you think you're so smart. You think you're so smart, but you're really not as smart as you think you are. Those in the know may feel superior to others who lack what they consider to be their elevated perspective. And so, you know, Paul's kind of throwing in a curveball. And, you know, Paul is trying to make a point here that they need not only to know God, but they need to be known by God. And that's certainly a big point, isn't it? That those who say that they love God really need to be known by God. And so the initiative of salvation and of acceptance comes from God and not from us. And that puts a whole different spin on it. What counts not so much is our knowledge of God, but God's knowledge of us, is what he's saying. So, with that point being made, he begins to address this idol meat question that the Corinthians had been writing about. Verse 4, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is only one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, to whom are all things and through whom we exist. And this is correct. Paul here, again, quoting a slogan from the Corinthian letter that was written to him, an idol is nothing at all in the world, and there's no God but one. Yes, they are correct in saying that. They are true, and they're true according to Judaism as well, that there's only one God. And so he doesn't disagree with this, but he has some things to say about the application. Because in the mind of the Corinthians, because the idol has no existence, then they are inferring that idol existence is a meaningless gesture. And again, remember what we saw in Acts and what we see in Revelation, that idol worship was not a meaningless gesture. And so they're inferring, because the idol is nothing and we worship one God, that this is all much ado about nothing. If we find it socially advantageous to eat idol meat, then what difference does it make? And so in verse 6, Paul writes, "Yet for us there is one God, the Father, through whom all things came and for whom we live. And there is but one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live." The Corinthians would certainly recognize this as an authoritative statement, that there's one God. It's just much like what we said. The Jewish people recognize this in Deuteronomy. You hear over and over, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the God, the Lord is one." And that's the truth that's being pointed out here. So what are the implications? Verse 7, Paul says, "However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do, but take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak." So he's challenging this premise that they all have this knowledge, or that, well, everybody knows that this is okay. He's insisting that, no, that everybody doesn't have this knowledge. This knowledge is to say everybody knows, everybody doesn't know. And not everybody shares in this. And so some members of this young congregation are so accustomed to thinking of idols as real that they can't eat the idol meat without being dragged back into the world of idol worship. The phrase in verse 8, "But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do." Also, that appears to be a statement that they have made that Paul is countering, because he answers, "But be careful about that, because your exercise of freedom can become a stumbling block to the weak." And so, you know, Paul's warning those who are tempted, well, we're going to flex our spiritual muscles here, and you need to watch out when you do that because of what effect it can have on others around you. In fact, if you hearken back to Matthew chapter 18, where Jesus was talking to people about being a stumbling block for the children, "Don't you be a stumbling block before these little ones who believe," they were told, "and it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the sea." You know, very, very extreme graphic terms that Jesus is using there about the danger of being a stumbling block. And the Corinthian brethren needed to recognize that this freedom that they thought that they had can be a stumbling block on those who those others that they're in contact with. In verses 10 through 12, Paul says, "For if anyone sees you who has knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble." And so, he gives a very specific description of how Paul imagines this possible damage could be inflicted on believers when there are those who want to force their right, you know, their so-called right to eat idol meat. And so you need to be aware of that. So from these verses, we see that Paul's primary focus is not what's being offered in the marketplace. He's concerned about those Christians that could have their conscience offended being drawn back into the idol temple. And the consequence of this kind of behavior that people are exhibiting is that the wheat can be destroyed. So, in verse 11, and Paul says, "And so by your knowledge the weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died." As I was preparing for this lesson, I read what somebody wrote about this, and they gave a personal application of when they began preaching. This was a person that, you know, probably teaching for a denomination in the way that this was written. But he said when he was first starting in the ministry, he was invited to some kind of dinner, and there were lots of other Christians that were there, and there was champagne on the table in the glasses, and he had never had champagne before, and he didn't even really realize what he was drinking. He picked it up and he took sips of it, and then he realized what it was and he didn't keep drinking it. But he said that there were some other young people that were there, and they told him afterwards, you know, we didn't know if we were supposed to drink that or not. You know, we knew it was alcohol. We didn't know if we should drink it or not. But when we saw you doing it, we knew it was okay. And so he knew that regardless of whether or not he was of the ilk that thought, well, you know, it's okay for me to drink as long as I don't get drunk, that this was a problem, and that he was going to limit whatever liberty he thought that he had in that regard. He was going to limit that because of the influence that he had on others. And Paul is telling these Corinthian brethren the same type of thing. You know, if you think it's okay to eat the meat, there are other considerations. And I don't think Paul's telling them that it's okay for them to do it. But he's telling them, you think that you have this liberty, but you need to draw that back. You need to dial it back and realize the influence that you're having on others. Because what he's saying here is, if verse 10, and think about verse 10 in contrast to what I just told you about this man drinking the champagne. If anyone sees you who has knowledge eating in the idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? So here's somebody that thinks this is wrong, and they see you who thinks it's okay, and you're doing it, you're eating in the idol's temple. Well, it must be okay if Randy's doing it. And so I'm going to do that, even though it violates my conscience. I see him doing it, so if the preacher can do it, then anybody can do it, right? Well, that's not what Paul is saying. He said, no, you need to dial that back. So by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed. You're encouraging somebody to violate their conscience because you've got to have your liberty and your freedom. So this is really the height of the argument here, and the focal point of this section is that, so this weak brother for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. Your haughty, puffed up knowledge that you think that you have is causing others to be destroyed. And so that's not what he wants. So he concludes here and says, thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. So you think that you have knowledge and freedom to do this, but you're being a bad influence on others and causing them to offend their conscience. And so what you have done, it, he doesn't say, well, the ones that are weak are the ones that are misled and they're sinning. No, he says, you sinned because you are causing others to offend their conscience. You are being a stumbling block. Verse 13, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So Paul said, I'm not going to make an issue out of eating meat if others are going to have a problem with that. So that was kind of the whirlwind 3,000 foot tour of 1 Corinthians 8. And there's other things that are said related to this in chapters 9 and 10 where Paul goes on further with talking about limiting his liberty and some other specific examples of the same type of situation. But what are some things that we can gain out of this? First of all, we have to realize, as Paul said, that knowledge is very good as far as knowledge is concerned, but it's something that can puff up. Knowledge should be used to grow an understanding of God's will And it certainly shouldn't be used in a way that would hurt our brothers and sisters, but rather help them. So no matter how much we know, our knowledge and understanding is incomplete. And as I said at the beginning of the lesson, I've skimmed this part of Corinthians for a long time and came away with a different understanding when I got more into it. And so, yeah, I've probably taught it wrong and made comments about it from time to time that are not part of my understanding now. And it may be down the road I'll study it further and find that I have to modify it again. And so it just makes lots of great sermons for the future, right? Because I can keep changing it. But that's certainly not my idea and my thought. I want to understand what it's saying. And the point is we have to realize, no matter how much we think we know, that our understanding is incomplete. And everybody that I have heard preach the gospel for many years has made the point that the more that they study, the more they realize they don't know. And that's kind of ironic, isn't it? But when we don't have a deep understanding of things, sometimes we think we understand things that we really don't. And Paul is taking those here to task that think that they have this knowledge but haven't really thought it through. We also need to apply this to ourselves, not to look down on others who don't seem to have the same knowledge. Because Paul's saying the ones that think that they have knowledge are really being detrimental to others. Paul wrote in Galatians chapter 5, verse 13, "You, my brothers, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature, rather serve one another in love." Another practical application here is that love builds up. Knowledge puffs up, love builds up, and we need to apply that when it comes to these kind of situations. And you can see here that people were more interested in proving themselves to be right rather than having a mind of what their influence was on somebody else. Another thing that we'll study as we go through this section is that the conscience is something that's very important and needs to be taken very seriously. We do not need to train ourselves to violate our conscience. And those that have a particular view or feel that they have a particular freedom on some subject sometimes can be impatient with those who don't have the same understanding. And you saw that here, that they're impatient, and Paul saying, no, we can't have that because it's going to destroy somebody else's conscience. And so we have to be patient in those kind of things and not seek to have our own way. I'd like to close the lesson with an illustration that I found recently. I thought it was a really good one. And just a few years ago when we and the family went to California, we went to Muir Woods, where there's lots of sequoias and redwoods. And if you've ever seen Return of the Jedi, nobody's seen that here, but if you ever see that movie and you see the race through the planet Endor, the forest moon of Endor. Sorry, Rick. The forest moon of Endor. They're racing through these trees, and it's filmed there with these trees. But these old trees are some of the oldest and tallest trees in the world. Up to